Hey, welcome back to another week of Fox on Sports on Bedford 105.1. I am Lauren Fox.
And I'm Andrew Hansen.
And not a whole lot going on in the world of sports.
Oh, no,
no,
of course not.
So, you know, I'm good. You know, do you have a phone book that we can read, maybe?
Nothing to
talk
about.
No, we have to fill the next hour, and this is just going to be really, really tough. There's nothing going on.
Well, I want to thank you for something.
What?
Thank you for not tripping me on the way into the studio.
Why would I have tripped you on the way into the studio?
Well, just to sort of interfere with my performance.
Oh, yeah. No, that... Well, why would I ever do a thing like that? Nobody would call.
Nobody would
on
see
it,
it or recognize
matter.
It. Yeah. I would just know myself.
Yeah, that was in the scale of incidental to egregious. That was pretty egregious.
That was close to egregious.
Yeah, so we're discussing the Bruins last night.
That was actually the word that Coach Cassidy used after the game.
Really?
He called it an egregious call.
Yes.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
It's a good word, and it makes it sound like you're mad and well-spoken and well-read at the same time.
He actually talked very intelligently about it for probably 30 seconds, and that was at the very end he said it was an egregious call. So it wasn't like he just went off and said, oh, that was egregious. I mean, he went through it and talked about how the NHL has sort of a black eye on it from the officiating throughout the playoffs, and then talked about how the culprit was on his way to the box. He was expecting the penalty to be called, and then he ended up calling it egregious.
Well, I mean, anybody who's really spoken to me in the last few weeks knows that I don't know. We talk about it on the air, and you make the comment. I always make the comment when I go to introduce the umpires, if we're calling a game, that hopefully we won't have to say their name at any point in time. And a good umpire or referee or linesman or whatever, they just do their job, and that's it. And I know if you're watching an NFL game, there are a million things that are going on at any given time, and the old line is, you could call holding on any play, and I'm reasonably certain of that. But everybody has a job, and they go ahead and do it. And it really looked like whoever, I don't even know who it was, just flat missed it. And when even the players know it and are willing to fall on their own sword, so to speak, for the penalty, it needs to be called. And, you know, I know that the – most of New England or those that are fans of the Bruins are kind of apoplectic about it this morning.
Yeah, the only thing I'll add, and certainly officiating in any sport is very, very difficult, but it did look like that perhaps there was another Bruin in between the referee and the play. So I thought that there was a chance he may have gotten screened. And so in the replay, you can't see the other referees, so I don't know what kind of angle they had on it. But the guy who was behind the goal line may have had his vision blocked a little bit.
That could be said to have happened on any play. And I don't know.
That's why they have three officials out there.
That's why referees. They have three officials out there. And that's why if you're looking at the high school game that we were doing the other day, they had three officials, which is up from your usual two that you'll have during the regular season. Or if you're in the case of freshmen or occasional JV games, one.
That's why in the major leagues, you go from four to six umpires.
Right. There's more stuff to see. And it makes logical sense. And I understand that officiating a hockey game is not an easy task because the amount, you have to really have your head on a swivel. You have to be a great skater.
Seriously.
It is a super tough job. However, we've talked about instant replay and the impact that instant replay can have on a game as far as just completely derailing the pace. I do think, you know, I don't know. There are always going to be missed calls. Just ask the New Orleans Saints.
Right.
Because they're exhibit A of missed calls really having an impact in a game. But there seems to me to need to be some kind of way that when something is just flat missed, I don't need the coaches to throw a flag. I need a handful of other people who aren't going to be on the ice and interfering with the flow of the game. I need other people just to be able to say, I'm pressing a button, stop it, go to the monitor and watch this.
Right, and then let's rewind the play.
Right.
Let's drop the puck for a face-off here so that the Blues don't get their second goal after the penalty that wasn't called.
Right, so it is unfortunate. Now the Bruins are behind 3-2. It really did look for all the world that when Boston was winning that game the other night, 7-2, and Jordan Binnington was being pulled in the second period, it looked for all the world like the Bruins were just going to run away. But this is, how many times do you see it in a seven-game series where one team looks like they're in complete disarray and they sort of figure things out and get back on track? It always happens. And really, now if you're Boston, you got to win the next two in a row.
Yeah, and you got to give credit to Binnington, and maybe that's just what he needed, to get pulled, sit there on the sidelines and watch for a bit and kind of regroup mentally. And you had to wonder at that time, how is this rookie going to react? You know, he's had an incredible run here through the second half of the season. And are the pressure of the finals going to be too much for him? But he's come back out. They've won two in a row, and he was excellent last night. So just a terrific performance by the rookie goalie.
Right. And for Binnington, too, he's one that the Bruins have familiarity with because he was a Providence Bruin. Back a couple years ago, the St. Louis Blues didn't have an AHL affiliate. And I know a town that could use one, but the St. Louis Blues didn't have an AHL affiliate, and Binnington wound up as a Providence Bruin. And, you know, by all accounts, did a good job, has now found his way back to the NHL. But, you know, you look at it, we've all seen it happen where, hey, we're going to go back to the guy who got us here, who might have been struggling, and sometimes he'll get it together, and sometimes he winds up like Yu Darvish in the World Series or Byung-Hyun Kim or any number of guys who just kind of hit a bad spell right at the wrong time of the year. So one of the things that has been interesting, at least it's kind of a fun storyline, is the St. Louis Blues changing up their game-winning song. And it was Run Around Sue by Dion for years, and now it is Gloria by Laura Branigan, which a 1982 hit. I honestly remember it well. I haven't been able to get out of my head for about 2 days, although I did have another song in my head that I'll go into when we're talking about the next thing. But the backstory behind this song, it's hilarious. And when you if for our listeners, if you haven't seen it on ESPN, go and find it. It's entertaining. But the long and the short of it is from what I can gather from this story, because it's what you can pick up in a minute and a half, there are these guys who were playing on a hockey team, probably not too much unlike our softball team.
Right.
And because they're interviewing some of the guys, and I'm sitting there saying, wait a second, that's him. Wait a second, that could easily be him. Or wait, that looks like so-and-so. And these guys were having a celebration because they had won a championship in a private bar, which I guess is their hockey team bar.
Okay.
In Philly, which really isn't a bad idea. I mean, if you're going to play on a recreational weekend warrior team, why not have your own private bar? What could possibly go wrong?
Oh, nothing.
It seems like a great idea. All the wives would love it. So these guys were having their celebration in their private bar. And what happens? It's just the random stuff. Somebody randomly invites some Blues player or some St. Louis Blues players who were in town to this private bar in Philly. And they're watching the Eagles and the Bears in a wild card or divisional game. And
the one from last year, the double doink?
I think so. And every time it went to a commercial break, somebody would flip on the music and play Gloria.
Okay.
And somebody would yell, play Gloria. It reminds me in strange ways of like hearing All Night Long by Lionel Richie. But they would yell, play Gloria. And they'd flip it on. And then the players the next day were somehow, you know, they won and somebody throws it on in the locker room and it became a thing.
So it was the local guys who were already playing Gloria and then the Blues were watching this and saying, oh, maybe we should try this.
The Philly guys were playing Gloria. The Blues guys were at the bar with
the local guys
okay. In Philly. Just bizarre. And one of the five guys that was there with the Blues at the bar just decided, oh, yeah, hey, click, let's put this thing on. and now it's their thing. And the bar has had t-shirts made. The dudes have, like, they were posting pictures on their Twitter of being at a Blues game, in a Stanley Cup game, because they went down there with Wayne Gretzky. I'm like, are you kidding me?
That's awesome.
So it's...
For the, those fans.
Well, yeah, it's awesome for those fans. But it's the kind of thing that for any of us who are like weekend warriors, this is sort of the stuff that you dream of. It would be like us sitting at the softball field and all of a sudden, I don't know, I'm going to throw it out there. Bryce Harper and Andrew McCutchen, pre-ACL tear, show up. And we're playing all night long, and those guys go, "Oh, hey, this is great!" And then the next thing you know, the entire town of Philly is listening to it as the Phillies are making a run. I don't know,
on repeat,
on repeat.
I mean, there's stations that are playing it like round the clock after each win,
as they should,
not just once,
and
for hours.
Well, and I understand that they're excited. I mean, this is their first chance at a cup. It's the first time they've been back in the Cup Finals in my lifetime. So I understand why.
Which is a long time.
It really is. I understand why they're excited. It was, you know, it has been interesting to see that. I don't think anybody's ever going to mistake St. Louis for a hockey town. We're so used to St. Louis having the best fans, in big quotes, with a heavy dose of sarcasm attached. The best fans in baseball.
Why are we sarcastic about that?
They're the self-proclaimed best fans in baseball.
Well,
I don't know. Just saying.
I give them credit for being very hospitable, as well as passionate fans, because I was out there for the World Series in 04, and they were congratulating us as Red Sox fans.
I know. It's that Midwestern nice.
Yeah, you wouldn't see that.
It's that weird, like...
You don't see that in New England.
It's like
with
somebody
a Yankees, Red Sox
No,
game.
Somebody walks up to you and says congratulations, and you go, great, what's the catch? Congratulations. Are you going to pat me on the back and stab me at the same time?
Right.
Like, that's the Midwestern nice. My overriding memory, because you would have been out there at the old Busch Stadium too,
yep.
I was out there, God, the next year or the year after, I don't remember which, but was the insane percentage of human beings in that ballpark that were smoking.
Okay.
Like, it was, I felt like I needed some kind of a respirator after I walked out of there, like just gasping, like, okay, maybe they just didn't get the memo about the negative health effects. Whatever.
That's a tough combination because it's also hot and humid out there.
Oh, dude, it's just acrid. The air just like sticks to you. It's an entity all its own, really.
Right.
Well, and then, yeah, you and I were out there for the PGA last year too. I don't know.
Brutally hot.
Yeah, it's not my favorite place on the planet, St. Louis. Let's just say that. But hey, you know, as a Boston sports fan, again, I'm going to say the same thing. It's way more fun when our teams win, regardless of whether I claim to know anything about hockey, which I know more than the average bear. I could tell you what icing is, but you know, I'm not familiar with the ins and outs of all the players. I am definitely not a hockey guy. But hey, it's our hockey fans, if you were to draw a Venn diagram, the hockey fans and the football fans, I don't think have quite as much overlap. I think hockey fans tend to go more at the baseball side of things.
Yeah.
So, but it's not like the baseball fans have been long suffering here either.
No, they haven't.
Unless you count like half a season as long suffering.
Right.
So, So the NHL, the officials kind of getting in the way just a little bit. The NBA, it's the fans getting in the way.
It is.
And
or team investors.
I hate to say it. I saw his name and I went, uh-oh.
I don't remember his name.
Mark Stevens.
And why did you say uh-oh?
He's a USC alum. He was on the cover of the Trojan Family magazine like 6 months ago.
Really?
Yeah, he's one of those dudes who, he's worth God's own fortune. Like, he's a Sequoia Capital guy. He graduated from SC back in the 80s. And is
82?
Now
his favorite song is Gloria.
Yeah, his favorite song was Gloria. Actually, Gloria came out after he graduated. But Mark Stevens was a venture capital guy who has continued to be relevant and is among the 1,000 richest people in the world. So that's
no kidding.
Yeah, that's rarefied air up there. It's like the opposite of the thick air in St. Louis, really. But Mark Stevens sitting in his courtside seat when Kyle Lowry does nothing more than dive after a loose ball. And my thought after they revealed who Mark Stevens was, because there were some interesting chapters going on with it. There were, well, we don't know who this guy is, and nobody in the local papers, interestingly enough, the local papers up in the Bay Area weren't saying who he was.
Okay.
They
didn't want to reveal the connection?
I think they were all waiting for somebody else to say something, and somebody who, maybe it was the NBA, said, yeah, this is who the guy is. The papers were worried about, if you spill the beans on who this guy is, now are you going to lose access to the team? Are you going to lose favor with the team? And that should never be a part of being a journalist.
No.
Particularly when it's something, to use our adjective du jour, as egregious as that. But for those who aren't familiar, because I was talking to my wife about it this morning while we were having a little bit of coffee, Kyle Lowry of the Toronto Raptors goes diving after a loose ball after a block by Serge Ibaka. And Kyle Lowry just he plays the game hard and goes after it. And
he went into the stands aggressively. I mean, he really dove after that ball.
But I've seen that level of aggression from somebody that I'm in the room with in a BMBL playoff game or regular season game. So when the stakes are that much higher and there's an NBA title
on
the line.
Those are the same stakes. Are you kidding me?
BMBL versus
the
NBA.
Same stakes.
Oh, well, I noticed our TV contract for the BMBL is
it being negotiated?
It's being negotiated. It's big. But so Lowry goes after it, trying to save a loose ball, because dude wants to pick up a win in Golden State and kind of take control of the series for all intents and purposes. And if you're a Toronto Raptor, you're thinking, I got to get while the getting's good. Like, Klay Thompson is hurt. DeMarcus Cousins isn't the same guy.
Durant is still out.
Like, we got to get a win in this thing, and I'm going to do whatever I can to do it. Lowry goes into the stands, and this would be Mark Stevens filed as, he may be a brilliant guy, he may be a brilliant businessman, but this has to be one of the dumbest smart guy things I've ever seen in my life. How can you not think when this happens that there are hundreds of, or not hundreds, probably dozens of cameras capturing every single possible angle of this NBA game, not to mention everybody who's got a camera that's part of their phone that's videoing the game just because they're there. And so there's no possible way that you could ever say, oh, it wasn't me, or I didn't mean to do that, or like, this guy was two seats away, as I demonstrated to my wife this morning, like a couch cushion is a hat and a half away. And you have the nerve to reach over and push this guy?
Well,
like,
that's the
thing. Are you out of your mind?
I don't even understand why he did it. You know, there was a woman next to him. So the thought crossed my mind, well, perhaps that's his wife.
Still not acceptable.
No, but perhaps he was defending her. He thought that Lowry hit her somehow on purpose. But you're right. He was more than a seat away. And so I just don't even understand what he was thinking to push Lowry. I mean, what message is he trying to send to him? Don't jump into the stands? How could he possibly have been motivated to push Lowry in that setting?
Well, and for anybody who says, well, Lowry's gotta know their fans there and gotta somehow go in gentler. We've seen it enough where people make that same kind of, well, okay, the guy's going in after a tackle and he's got to adjust. You and I, and you probably have closer an idea, but you and I have no idea. All right, first of all, this guy is faster than I am. He's bigger than I am. He's stronger than I am. And he's going after a ball. There's no way that he's going to be able to go, I'm going to make an adjustment and stop in midair and just defy gravity and just fall down. Like, it's his job to get after the ball.
The only way he's going to save that ball is if he makes contact with the crowd.
Right. And he knows that going in, and he's going to go ahead and do it. And, like, Stevens has no right to touch him. It's completely, it's not acceptable. And you, guy's doing his job. You know you're sitting courtside. You know that there's a chance that that's going to happen. And part of the appeal of sitting courtside is precisely that it might happen. So when it does happen, you can't be angry and shove the guy. And I don't remember who said, it's both teams, both Golden State and Toronto have come out unanimously against the actions of Mark Stevens. But you think about it, and I don't remember who mentioned it this morning or the last night. If Lowry returns the favor and shoves Stevens, he's suspended for how many games? Are charges being pressed against him?
It was Draymond Green.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, a Warrior who took that perspective. And Steph Curry came out and said that's unacceptable, knowing who the transgressor was. And even Coach Kerr apologized on behalf of the Warriors directly to Kyle Lowry.
Yeah, like, what can you be thinking that, okay, this guy's invaded my personal space and I'm just going to shove him? Like, not cool. Like, in no circumstances is that cool. And will that ever be cool? Like, so I am, they levied a $500,000 fine against him, which, I don't know, what's 500 divided by 1.06 billion?
Not much.
Yeah. I'm going to do the math.
It's about what you'd find between those two cushions on your couch that you were talking about?
It's 0.04%. So, yeah. I mean, really, it's like finding...
It's not even a slap on the wrist. it's like a brush.
It's like finding me a dime.
Yeah.
You know, exactly. I know you can't... There can't be a sliding scale where if somebody who's a gazillionaire gets a speeding ticket, that speeding ticket costs him $150,000 because that equates to whatever for one of us.
But right.
Even still, $500,000 is nothing to Mark Stevens. I mean, he underwrote the USC entrepreneurship, one of the divisions of the business school with a $22 million check 15 years ago. So,
wow.
Yeah, I mean, but still, I don't know. I don't care of all the good stuff you've done. I understand that and I respect that, and I'm sure he's done a lot of good stuff on the way, and I hope that even if there's some kind of a symbolic gesture to, like, all right, we're going to shake hands and make up and everything's going to be fine. His apology was good.
Right.
Like,
that's how you make an apology.
Right.
Yes.
That is how you make an apology. There was no but, or there was no I felt that.
Right.
It's I screwed up, I'm sorry.
And Commissioner,
I will accept my punishment.
Commissioner Silver pointed to that and saying that's part of the reason why he was only fined what he was, because
right.
of how contrite he was.
Voldemort did a great job on that one. So, all right, we'll take a quick break. We're going to come right back with Billy Chapman of the Bedford High School baseball program. You are listening to Fox on Sports on Bedford 105.1. Welcome back to Fox on Sports on Bedford 105.1. Lauren Fox, Andrew Hansen, and we have with us Bedford High varsity baseball coach Billy Chapman, who has a big game coming up, I guess, to say the least. The six-seeded Bulldogs have made their way to the NHIAA Division I championship game against Londonderry. That'll be 7 p.m. Monday night at Northeast Delta Dental Ballpark. So, Coach, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
So a month ago, the Bulldogs were coming off a really rough start to the season. You were without the services of what you thought at the time were going to be your top two pitchers. At that point, the team's 1-4. How do you hold it together and ensure that the team and the season don't fall apart at that point?
There was a conversation between myself and the team, and I just kind of told them that not to panic, that they had to remember that even though we were 1-4, three of those losses were one run or extra inning affairs where we actually were, you know, one hit away or in the position to kind of win the game. And we kind of let it slip away. So they had to keep that in mind, that it wasn't going to make or break the season just yet. We still had a long way to go.
Yeah, if you look at the trajectory of the season, that's completely accurate. You're talking about losses that were close ones to Londonderry, to Concord. Really, the only game that hasn't fallen into that category is the opening game of the season, that loss to Keene. And you've been around the Bedford program a long time. You liken this team to your 2014 squad. That started 1-6, wound up finishing 11-7, so winning 10 of their last 11. Was that your most satisfying year before this one?
I don't know. It's kind of hard. I mean, that was a really good group of kids, the 2014 group. They were young. We ended up that most of those kids, we went to the state championship the next year in 2015 for the first time in Division One. And they really weren't, some of them weren't really like what you'd call a like college level or high level ball players. They were just really athletic. They were a good group. They were competitive. That was a fun group. The year you win to that in 2016, the year you win the state championship, maybe like the most satisfying. We were coming off of a season where we lost 14 players and everyone had us pegged kind of like this year to be a rebuilding year. We didn't start off 1-4 that year. We ended up finishing like 19-2 and winning it. This year has been pretty special. I don't know if I've had as much fun coaching a group of kids as I've had with this group. Every day they show up and they make me laugh. They work hard. They stay loose. And I think we had to kind of find our identity early in the season, and I think we did.
Yeah, you guys have really come together, and it's an amazing accomplishment as you get ready for your fifth straight championship appearance. So as we look ahead to that, let's talk a little bit about this semifinal game where you guys beat Portsmouth 1-0, and it was a crazy play in the third inning that allowed you guys to score, fifth inning, sorry, that allowed you guys to score your only run. So walk us through that play as there's a man on first and Fletcher hits it hard towards the first baseman. You know, what did you see from the third base coaching area as that play developed?
Well, I knew that we had Ryan Giuliano on first, and as soon as the ball was hit, it was hit hard, and it, ricocheted into basically right center. I knew we were going first to third. I had that was easy. Like, Ryan picked that up right away, and then it's kind of hard. Like, this is probably one of the harder decisions, or you don't really – it's kind of hard to even remember because it happened so fast. But I asked Ryan about it, and he kind of said I was giving him the full arm circle coming towards third. And then I kind of just stopped, and I was kind of just waving my hand a little bit, like circling my hand around. And that was me kind of just watching. And when he got to second base, I was kind of watching the center fielder, and he wasn't really sprinting towards the ball. And then I saw him throw into second. I didn't realize Zach was trying to take second at the same time, which is, he was just out of the box. He was just going full tilt, hustling, and trying to get into scoring position. And as soon as I saw the throw coming into second, I don't think I waved Giuliano on. I just said go. Like, he was close enough to me where I was just like, score, score, score. And, they threw into second. I don't think their player necessarily was prepared at the time, too, because it would have been a very tight play. I rewatched the video, and it was going to be a close play at second base, which would have ended the inning. But the ball skipped through the shortstop, and then there wasn't even a throw to the plate.
Yeah, there were so many odd things going on because Hansen said he's watched it three times. He's watched it more now because we watched it a couple times this morning. But from the ball going off the first baseman's foot and basically winding up a solid 80 feet away from that, to you hit it right on the head. Cal Hewitt in center field took kind of a slow jog at it to begin with and then went full bore at it. But when he picks the ball up in right center field and barehands it, it looks like Zach's about 35 feet from first base. So he's give or take 55 feet away from second base. But Hewitt's still got to cock and throw and get that into second base. The throw is just a little bit off the line. And, the things that you're curious about, all right, if Zach sees that throw is right there and he's dead to rights, there's nobody standing on first base. So Zach can easily get back there. Worst case scenario, he gets in a rundown long enough that RJ is able to score. But from Portsmouth defensively, their first baseman was set up anticipating a play at the plate, which would really seem to be the most logical thing at that point. It's almost like Cal Hewitt looked up and saw the shortstop standing on second, the first baseman standing just off of second base because he was lined up basically from right center field. And it looked like Cal Hewitt had kind of a little bit of indecision and almost split the difference on those two, allowing Fletcher to get into second, but also making your job way easier sending RJ around.
Yeah, I think the play came down to the fact that, and Cal is a very good player. He's going to be going to Vanderbilt. to play next year. I think he got caught kind of being a little lazy. And if he had sprinted over to the ball and really got there quickly, I think it would have changed that play a lot. I still think we would have gone first to third, but I think Zach out of the box knew that the first baseman had left, and he kind of took advantage. He turned a single into a double, really, and that's something that we kind of preach all the time is, go hard out of the box, and if they're lazy, try to take second base if they lob one in. And I think Zach just kind of caught Cal off guard, and I think caught the whole defense off guard, and that was able to help us score Ryan from third.
Yeah, and to your point, if Zach Fletcher doesn't go hard into second to draw that throw, maybe the run doesn't score. So it's his aggressiveness that really led to that run being scored.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, if he didn't try to go to second, I think we don't score that run there.
And my guess is we'd probably still be playing at this point.
We might be. That was it was a very tough battle. I mean, both pitchers were lights out. I mean, we'd basically, it was the same matchup from the regular season. I thought that we had a couple more runners on than they did. We just couldn't have that big hit until Zach put that one off the first baseman's foot.
It was well-timed and much-needed. We're here with Bedford High baseball coach Billy Chapman, and the names that we're throwing out when we're talking about that play are Ryan Giuliano, who's a freshman, and Zach Fletcher, who's a sophomore. You have a lot of sophomores playing big roles, and then RJ's been playing a big role for you as well. How have those players picked up, of course you had three freshmen at the varsity level last year. How have those players gotten acquainted with everything that you need them to do as quickly as they have?
I think last year was an anomaly of keeping three freshmen. I think there's only been a handful of freshmen I've ever kept on varsity. Nick Angelini just graduated from Bryant as a center fielder there. Grant drafted. And then those three, Kyle Levine, Zach Fletcher, and Michael Pratt, probably all going to college to play ball as well. And then Ryan. And then after that, there's been no other freshman I've ever moved up. And I think I guess what I would say is I try to make a sustainable program where every year we can compete for a state championship. And I had this vision that I knew last year I was going to need to get some kids experience for the next year. So I knew that this year was going to be a year of youth. And the only way to offset that was to really make sure that I got some of those kids playing time last year. So Kyle caught a lot, didn't hit as much. Zach and Michael competed for playing time. Zach got a little hot towards the end, so he hit for us last year. And Michael got to see a lot. And those kids, they didn't have bad attitudes about not playing. I think they were able to watch the game and understand it, and then they worked hard in the off season, and then they just kind of ran with their roles. And I think that's part of the 1-4 start, is you have to kind of understand the game picks up a little bit. And I think Ryan struggled a little bit at first. He had a couple big hits for us, but then he's really come on lately, and he's handled shortstop extremely well for a freshman. I don't know if I've seen a freshman handle it as well as he has.
Well, and it gives you a lot of flexibility, too, because you take a very good defensive second baseman in Trevor and you put him on the mound, and you can shift T.J. Crowley over to second base, move R.J. over to short, and it's just sort of being able to lock the right puzzle pieces in that can make things much easier on you. So speaking of some of these guys, too, you have players who've been on a state championship Little League team in Pratt and Fletcher, Kyle Levine, of course, Grant was, but of course, he's moved on, among others. When you have players who have been in the bright lights, so to speak, of that regional down in Bristol, Connecticut, does that help them deal with some of the pressure situations that they might see on a varsity diamond?
Yeah, I mean, I think Bedford's a baseball town. They've had a lot of success in the lower levels as well. I think Ryan they were a state championship Little League team.
Yes, they were.
They went to Bristol.
Yeah.
And, I think it's part of what they're used to. We like to win, and they have won a lot, and they play together. And they play together. A lot of them play together. A lot of those kids are NEB guys in the summer. You're talking Zach, Michael, and Kyle. They play together, AAU as well through Black Flies with Kevin Levine. And now they play NEB. I mean, I think you mix that, they're competitive, they're talented, and they have won before, and I think they've been in pressure situations, so I think that does help.
Well, hopefully it'll help on Monday, Coach. That's the next big game for your guys. It's the state championship against Londonderry. And when you played Londonderry in the regular season, your guys got to face Nolan Lincoln on the mound. If he takes the hill on Monday, how big will that regular season experience be that your guys got against him?
It will help. We saw them a while ago, and I think he's definitely improved a little bit. I watched him pitch against Concord, and he did really well mixing it up. I'd be interested to see who they do throw. They know that we faced Nolan before, and they do have another player, Reese Manor, that they pitched in the second round, who throws pretty well, who kept Pinkerton to one run. They give up a little bit when they put Reese on the mound because he's their shortstop, so I don't know if, again, that will be a decision that Coach Demas makes, and I won't know until the game starts. I think if we do face Nolan again, I mean, it will be helpful. One of the things that we do is we track all of our pitchers that we face, so we have charts on them and what they throw in each count. And my players do look at it. We go over percentages. We talk about that part of the game, and they have the chart in the game so that they can kind of see what he's done in the past to us and what he's doing to us in the game in terms of, you know, what is he throwing first pitch versus 0-2, things like that. But, yeah, it will be – it's always good when you've seen a kid before. But he's going to be good, and he kind of throws three-quarter, sidearm almost, and they have another kid who does that. So they're very crafty on the mound.
It will be interesting to see, and I know we're looking forward to it as well. Well, Coach, enjoy the weekend. Enjoy that last tune-up until Monday night's championship game, and we'll be up in the booth rooting for you.
All right, thank you very much.
Thank you. As I press all the buttons to hang everything up, that was Bedford High varsity baseball coach Billy Chapman heading to the state championship 5 years in a row, and tough one coming up Monday night against Londonderry.
Yeah, it's going to be a lot of fun, and we're expecting that Trevor Annibal will be back on the mound. He's been the ace here, and he's just been piling up the strikeouts, and we talked about that on the broadcast, and he's up almost at 100 strikeouts now for the year. And in honor of his excellence on the mound, I thought we'd do a little quick baseball trivia here for the trivia man, Lauren Fox.
Yeah.
So in honor of Annibal's excellent K rate on the mound, did you notice who was the most recent entrance into the top 20 club for all-time strikeouts by Major League Baseball pitchers? Who is the new number 20 on the list?
How many does he have?
About 2,820.
Max Scherzer?
Nope. Let's see if Max is on the list. He's not.
Max has got to be close.
He does pile them up, but he doesn't have as many years of experience as this pitcher does.
2,820 strikeouts.
Active player.
Not CeCe?
CeCe is 17th all time.
CeCe's over 3,000. Okay, so that's fair. So it's sort of that same vein then.
Right-handed pitcher.
Not helping.
I just cut it almost more than in half.
No, you didn't.
For starters? All right, he pitches for Houston. He hasn't pitched for them for long. He came from Detroit.
Is it Verlander?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
Surprising, huh? Top 20 all time.
That's not really surprising. He's been around a while.
Well, then why didn't he pop to the top of your head?
Because I thought he would be higher.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Well, don't pull anything up here. We're going to continue this trivia.
Okay, let's go.
All right. So let's see if you can get 10 of the top 20 on the list.
Okay.
With only, ready? Well, I'll give you one miss. Okay. So you got to get 10 out of 11 guesses.
Okay. Nolan Ryan.
One.
Is one. That's easy. Randy Johnson.
Two.
Is two. Walter Johnson.
Is number nine.
Steve Carlton.
Steve Carlton is number four.
Let's see. So three. Anybody who's got 3,000 is on the list.
That's
so,
correct.
Don Sutton.
Don Sutton is number seven.
people in New England are like, Who's Don Sutton?
curly hair.
Yeah, sweet 70s hair. I said Steve Carlton.
You already got him.
Tom Seaver.
Tom Seaver's number six. You're wearing out the top 10 here. This is good. I'm giving you top 20.
I know.
You don't have to stay in the top 10, but you can if you want. You've got six so far.
I'm like lost on who I already have hit.
I mean, I guess we can give you CeCe and Verlander.
Nah.
We'll give you CeCe. Okay. We won't count Verlander because you didn't get him.
Greg Maddux.
Greg Maddux is number 10.
Okay. So
you're up to eight with CeCe.
Okay. I'm going through like franchise. I'm sitting here watching the clock go around too.
That probably won't help.
That's not helping at all.
I mean, you're eight for eight though.
I am, but I'm like now I'm just kind of all right. Who's
take a sip of your coffee if you need it.
Hang on. I'm trying to, God, I'm now like thinking of guys that obviously aren't, but were like strikeout kings where I'm like Herb Score, Dwight Gooden, no, J.R. Richard, no. Because a lot of the high strikeout guys were in and gone.
Dwight Gooden is number 57.
No, I know Dwight Gooden's not anywhere near it.
Yeah, we're not going to count that against you.
Yeah, no. Roger Clemens.
Roger Clemens is on the list at number three.
So at least I got there because I started thinking about the 80s.
Nine for nine so far. You just need one more.
I need one more.
So many choices.
I know, and I'm just I don't want to screw it up. You realize?
Yeah,
this.
I'm giving you one.
What? I know, but I don't want X. that. That's not the point. Hang on, like you have to fill something while I'm thinking because I can't think and talk at the same time.
So I'm thinking about the clues that I'm going to have to give you.
Robin Roberts, or did he get dropped down by a bunch of the new guys?
Yeah, he must have gotten dropped down. That's your ex.
That's an ex right there. Wow.
He's number 51.
Well, okay.
How can you get?
He would never have been that high.
You've gotten eight. You've gotten eight of the top 10, and you just dropped down to number 51.
Was Tom Glavine in the top 20?
Oh no! Did you just miss a second? Tom Glavine is number 26. Oh gosh.
Well, no. I'm trying to. I'm thinking more along the lines of longevity guys. Gaylord Perry, was he in there?
There you go. He's number eight.
Okay.
All right. So now you've gotten everyone in the top 10 except number five,
who
would have been the toughest of the top 10 to get. Burt Blyleven.
Oh, Burt Bjelm Blyleven. There you go.
So you missed a couple. I mean, come on, Mr. Boston fan. You missed two Red Sox of recent form.
Pedro and Curt Schilling?
Yep. Pedro's number 13 and Curt Schilling's number 15.
Really?
You missed the Brave that is on the list that you haven't mentioned. Not Glavine, but
Smoltz. Steve Avery.
Smoltz is number 16.
Not Stephen Avery of Making a Murder fame, but Steve Avery, the pitcher. No.
So the rest of the list, number 11, Phil Niekro.
You know, I was going to say Phil Niekro, and then I was like, you know what? He doesn't, but he does. Obviously.
Number 12, Ferguson Jenkins.
Ah, Fergie Jenkins, yes.
Number 14, the Cardinals pitcher from the 60s.
Bob Gibson. Oh, geez. Yep. The best baseball story ever.
Number 18, Ball 4. The book? Isn't that the name of the book?
Yeah, but he didn't strike out that many guys.
Jim Bunning?
No, Jim Bouton was the one.
Oh, Jim Bouton, okay.
Jim Bunning was the senator from Kentucky.
Okay. 19, Mickey Lolich. And number 20 was Mike Mussina, but now it's Justin Verlander. So there you go. And Cy Young is 22nd.
Yeah, you know, I thought about that because I'm like, the dude went 511 and 313, like, with that many decisions, he must have, but then
did they even track strikeouts back then? Apparently they did.
Probably not. Not to the extent that they should have. So, yeah, there you go. No, I wouldn't have. I don't know.
Trevor Anibal, he might get to 100 this season if he pitches on Monday, which is really outstanding.
Do you know who your all-time season leader is?
Is it not Nolan Ryan?
It is Nolan Ryan.
Okay.
Do you know how many?
383.
There you go. Whose record did he beat? Our audience is snoring.
Sandy Koufax.
There you go. That is the correct answer. Sandy Koufax had 382. It's like the things you remember from being a kid. Like, of course, when I was a kid, I was reading every possible baseball book I could ever get my hands on. And I had a Nolan Ryan like biography circa 1980 or whatever. And in that book, it had Nolan Ryan sitting there with a plate of 383 silver dollar pancakes.
Which he ate in about 12 minutes.
I always thought it was kind of cool, yeah. Well, the other Nolan Ryan absolutely amazing fact that I love is the fact that when Robin Ventura went out to charge the mound,
yeah,
like, and made the decision that, all right, I'm going out there after him, that Nolan Ryan was older than I am now.
That is a good stat.
Nolan Ryan was 46. Ventura came out. Nolan got him in a headlock and just started rabbit punching him in the face.
I mean, not Robin's smartest move to make that journey.
If you read the article, though, or read interviews with him, he knew exactly what he was going into, but it was one of those, I kind of have to do this.
Right.
Like, I don't want to go out there and charge my dad, but I don't really have a choice in this matter. Like, but when you read the whole story leading up to everything that went into the whole fight, like, the game has changed so much in the last 25 years where guys are getting hit and no warnings are being issued. And, like, yeah. And then, of course, I don't remember if I talked about this on air because I know I talked about it with my team. The guy who saved Nolan Ryan at the bottom of the pile in that fight.
Don't think you've talked about this on air. So we didn't talk about
it on air. You know who saved, who pulled, he basically was pulling guys off him and then pulled him out of there?
Who?
Played for the White Sox, but not known as a White Sox.
Harold Baines?
Known as a Royal.
What team was he on then?
He was a White Sox player at that point.
And he's known as a Royal?
He's known as a Royal. Short career. Storied career.
Who is it?
Bo Jackson.
Okay.
Bo Jackson was the guy who saved Nolan Ryan in that pile.
Wow.
Yeah. So, hey. Now it can be told, I guess, right?
So Nolan Ryan needed to be saved at that
point? Nolan Ryan, like, somehow the two of them were fighting, and the next thing you know, there's, like, a pile of people, and Ryan was on the bottom of the pile, and Bo Jackson extricated him from that.
Okay.
So, all right, we'll take a quick break. We'll come right back with New Hampshire Union leader, baseball writer Roger Brown. You are listening to Fox on Sports on Bedford 105.1. Welcome back to Fox on Sports on Bedford 105.1. Lauren Fox, Andrew Hansen, and being that I feel like this show, we talked a little bit about hockey. We didn't talk about Jeopardy. We talked about the NBA for a bit, but it has really been baseball through and through. What better time to be joined by the New Hampshire Union leaders, baseball writer Roger Brown. Roger, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, guys.
Hey, we appreciate you coming on. A little over a month ago, as we're heading into the NHIAA Division I Championship, a little over a month ago, Bedford was 1-4, and things didn't look terribly bright for the Bulldogs. Londonderry was 6-0. At that point, would you have seen Bedford making a run if you had had a crystal ball?
Well, I certainly wouldn't have counted them out because, you know, I knew to a certain degree their talent level was pretty good. And I also was pretty sure, although it was early in the year, that quite a few of those teams that they played early on, you know, those were strong teams. I believe they had Concord in there, Londonderry, Portsmouth, maybe even Keene, I believe. So I knew, you know, Bedford was a little young, so they had some growing to do, plus the level of competition they were facing early. You know, I didn't dismiss them after that start for sure. And just talking to the Billy Chapman, their head coach, and some of their players, they felt their turnaround came at the Pinkerton game in second week of May, and that's when I really was sold on them as well. They looked very sharp that day against a strong Pinkerton team, and really at that point on, I was sold on them as being as pretty much as good as anybody in the state. So from that point on, I wasn't surprised at what they had done.
They've had an interesting year, a lot of one-run games, a lot of whether it's wins or losses. And as they matured through the season, they sort of figured out how to win those close games. But if you're the Bulldogs, the last 2 years they got knocked out by Exeter in the finals. This year, Exeter was a first-round victim at the hands of Dover. Were you surprised by the fact that Exeter went out as early as they did?
Yeah, stunned, I would say, would be the word. Exeter was, I won't say by far, but they were the best team I saw this year by a good amount. You know, they were without their best player for most of the season. They got him back late, Garrett Roberts. So they looked like they were going to be clicking on all cylinders in the postseason. And they just ran into a tough matchup that day against Dover. Couldn't hit their pitcher. Very surprised. And not to take anything away from Bedford, but, you know, they caught a break there because, you know, Exeter wasn't in their bracket. And then, you know, they've caught a few more breaks after that. You know, they played BG and they had a little bit of controversy there where Bishop Gurton's catcher refused to play that day, one of the best players in the state. And then, you know, they end up with a 10th seed in the semifinals. So things have broken in Bedford's favor, you know, on their path to this championship game, but they've certainly earned it. You know, they've done what they had to do as well. So you can't take anything away from them. They can only play who's put in front of them, and they've won those games. So, but to answer your question about Exeter, yeah, they would have been my pick to win it again this year when the postseason began.
Now, you mentioned the BG controversy. That was Alex George who elected not to play that day. And when I went back and watched the broadcast of the game, that was mentioned as well. An odd thing that transpired. And is there any further information about that? It was kind of odd is really the only way I can describe it.
Yeah, I wasn't there that day. So, everything I've heard was secondhand. You know, I know BG has several very good defensive catchers. What I was told is they planned on using Alex as a designated hitter that day. He's their number three hitter. He's an exceptional player. He's going to Southern New Hampshire to play there. I can only assume that he was a little upset about not being in the lineup as a catcher and only as a DH. But again, I was not there, and none of this is firsthand information.
Right. All I heard was basically what you said, that Alex George wasn't going to be in the lineup that day, wasn't playing, and not related to an injury. And certainly a shame and a difficult way to go out and to end your senior year. But I don't want to focus on that. For Bedford, and we're with Roger Brown and the New Hampshire Union Leader, they started the season with a young roster. 5 of the 9 are underclassmen. Is it typical for you that you would see a team mature like this as the season goes on?
Yeah, I mean, not a surprise at Bedford. I mean, those kids have played a lot of baseball. It's a baseball town. You know, typically, if you've got a young group, you hope to get better as the season goes along. You know, that's what a coach is looking for from his team. And again, these Bedford kids are all seasoned baseball players. They've had a lot of success, I'm sure, at the lower levels. So I would have expected to see some progress, you know, certainly through the course of the year, which you get out of most good teams, you know. Now, there's a couple teams out there that I think people would have picked to be in the championship game or make a run at it this year, and although those teams had good seasons, I wouldn't say they improved through the course of the year. They kind of plateaued early, and you know, that can be the difference between winning a title or playing in a championship game and just having, you know, a winning season. So you know, you're always looking to get better, and clearly that's what Bedford did this year.
So that the next matchup for Bedford with that title on the line is going to be Londonderry, and you were there for the semifinal matchup between Concord and Londonderry that the Lancers won 4-1. What stood out to you about the performance by the Lancers in their win?
The top of their batting order is very good. I think their first two hitters, Brandon Fish and Reese Manner, are both hitting well over 400. So those guys got on base. Particularly, they got a three-run. I think it was a three-run second inning, and they both had hits in that inning. Got things going. And they were, you know, they were a problem for Concord, and they've been a problem for everybody this year. So, not just they have depth in their batting order for sure, but the top of that order is going to be something that Bedford will have to deal with successfully to come out with a victory probably on Monday.
Now, how about on the mound? We understand that Nolan Lincoln had a complete game in that semifinal matchup with six strikeouts, and we don't know if he'll go on Monday. But if he does, for the Bedford fans, how would you describe his pitching style?
Well, you know, I'm expecting it to be Trevor Anibal against Nolan Lincoln, but who knows? And while Trevor is certainly can be a dominating pitcher, you know, when you just watch him, you can see he's got tremendous curveball. He can get a lot of strikeouts. Nolan isn't quite as impressive visually, but his results are very good. He's just a very consistent pitcher. Not an overpowering fastball, but good enough to get it by weaker hitters. Mixes his pitches well. And very consistent for the year. I think he's 6-5. I believe he's allowed 8 earned runs all year. So he could be 8-1 or something like that. Just been consistent. You know, I think he threw 7 innings against Bedford in the regular season as well.
Yeah, and unfortunately, we didn't see that game earlier in the season, but Lincoln was successful, and of course, Londonderry did not see Trevor in that game. Nick DeWitte started on the mound, and the sophomore Michael Pratt wound up taking the loss for the Bulldogs in extra innings, so it will be interesting. Do you think, you know, sometimes you were talking about Lincoln being a deceptive pitcher. Do you think seeing him for a second time might give the Bulldogs a bit of a leg up?
Well, it certainly should be helpful if he does pitch. You know, it's just like seeing a guy third time through the order or whatever. You know, you kind of figure him out a little bit. But I will say, you know, the reason Londonderry has been so successful this year is have a number two
And I think we're losing Roger Brown a little bit. What he was saying was having a number two like Reese Manner, which oddly enough is the same thing that Billy Chapman was saying as well. But having that depth among your starting rotation really can make a big difference as well. We'll see if Roger's still hanging out there.
We caught him en route from one event to the next.
Yes. So, all right. We're right up against the end of the show, so wanted to take a quick moment, thank our guests, Bedford High varsity baseball coach Billy Chapman, as well as Roger Brown of the New Hampshire Union Leader. Thank my co-host Andrew Hansen, as well as the crew here at Bedford 105.1, Harry Kozlowski, Colleen Richardson, and Bill Jennings. And have a great sports week. We will see you at Northeast Delta Dental Ballpark on Monday night at 7 o'clock, where the Bedford Bulldogs will take on the Londonderry Lancers in the NHIAA Division I baseball final. And we'll be live on the air from that as well. So thank you again. Have a great sports week. You've been listening to Fox on Sports on Bedford 105.1.